Well, certainly there has been lots of commentary this week. It's tapped some of our basic values and prejudices, though, haven't you noticed? And in some ways, the best contributions so soon admit they're rather baffled, because it's not easy to pigeonhole these events. For me, one of the best pieces has been by Lance Price, a former media advisor to Number 10, republished in yesterday's Australian Financial Review, because it was genuinely searching for answers instead of just fulminating, and it had a bit of black humour about it too. In the high street nearest my home, wrote Lance Price, the bookshop stood out as the one business not to have been looted. But elsewhere in London, antique shops were spared too, and high-end clothes stores were largely untouched. This wasn't class war. The attackers didn't go marauding around Chelsea or Knightsbridge. Harrods wasn't ransacked. For the most part, the rioters were attacking their own communities and clearing the shelves of the stores they themselves liked to shop in. This wasn't street protest. It was a kind of consumerism. And just one more before I go to my two guests. David Aronovich, writing in The Times, he lives in Tottenham, where it all started, wrote this about some of the boys, black and white, who were involved. They will now often return to estates that have been improved out of all recognition since the riots of the 80s. They're very much less likely than their fathers to have suffered from police harassment. Far from their being forgotten and marginalised, a lot of time and effort has been spent on them and their peers. Not for lack of trying, we haven't persuaded them to get qualifications or unglamorous starter jobs. So let me now introduce Clive Bloom, Professor Emeritus at the University of Middlesex, and he's the author of Violent London, 2,000 Years of Riots and Rebels. He's speaking to us from his home in London. And Cheryl Curnow's with us too, who Australian audiences will know well. She's now Associate Professor at the Centre for Social Impact at the University of New South Wales, but until early last year, I think, was Director of Learning at the School for Social Entrepreneurs in London. And she spent much time observing contemporary Britain and wrote interestingly about it this week on Crikey. So Clive and Cheryl, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Julie.
Good morning.
Clive Bloom, do you think this was quite unlike anything that's gone before or not?
It seems on the surface to be different from things that have gone on before. We've obviously had riots in the past. We can go through all of those from Grosvenor Square in 68 to the poll tax riots and all sorts of things. The difference is, I think, that we have to look very further back to find out what this sort of riot looks like. And we have to go back to the 18th century. We have to go back to the sort of young men who were apprentices in the 18th century, many of them teenagers, who were disenfranchised, alienated, disenchanted, just like they are now, who also went in for aspirational rioting, also went in for consumption and stealing things. They would riot, they would... If they had a grievance, they would march down the street, they would break windows, they would set fire to people's houses that they didn't like, and they would steal the furniture and the clothes and anything else they could get hold of and go home well contented. So we have to go back to the 18th century style of mob, the criminal mob, rather than look at political riots or any sort of riot that has a sort of political agenda. That's not the right place to start.
How do you think it through, Cheryl?
Well, I think that it's about fundamental universal truths about humans and life and their needs. And while the symptoms might be similar, I think the causes are a bit more complicated these days. And I think that Britain in 2011 is very different from centuries ago. I mean, the population makeup, for start, but the size of the population, you know, the huge human pressure on social infrastructure in what is essentially a tolerant welfare state is, it's hugely fraying at the edges, and some of it's not its own fault. I mean, the EU influxes, which cause need for housing and use of health services, the return, you know how yesterday's solutions become tomorrow's problems? Well, you know, imperialism come home to roost with the huge influx of Commonwealth migrants, the acceptance of asylum seekers and refugees, and the need for acres and acres of social housing for these people. So I think the system is different from what existed, but I agree that lack of anger management, disconnection, a sense of disenfranchisement, all of those things still exist.
I think what struck me about the piece you wrote, and some very interesting remarks too that came on the Crikey website from people, was that you suggested that a lot of Australians don't grasp the bleakness of contemporary Britain.
Well, there are two Britons. There's the most wonderful, articulate, civil, affluent middle class, whose children binge drink, though, nevertheless. And it's a very nourishing, intellectually satisfying place to live in that those parts of London. But there's this really frightening bleakness of many of the ghettos of housing estates where I walked through to work in a community job I was doing for a while, and the kind of perverse solidarity which comes together around things like police. And I heard that young girl say, "This will show the police they need to respect us." Mm. And I felt a sense of despair that I've seen these young women, I've seen these teenage mums, I've seen them not look at their children when they're crying in the tube. And I ask myself, how do you learn about connectedness when the person you're most supposed to be connected to turns away from you, has headsets in her ears, and texts incessantly, and other people in the train frantically try to connect with the baby's eyes to give it some sense of someone cares about you? And similarly, how do you learn about shared communal space when the enforced space you live in is always filthy, where other tenants use the lifts as places to urinate, where they throw rubbish everywhere, and even the best and decent struggling people in the world have to put up with this and live in fear on a daily basis? I mean, these are the ingredients, in my view, of complete social dysfunction.
Now, Clive, I've got to ask you this that was pointed out, that the riots, whatever they are, have not spread to Scotland. Because we must be careful about using the word Britain, because I get into a lot of trouble from listeners for this. And they've not spread to Scotland and Wales. There's been little things in Wales, but really not much. Now, is there any clue? What does your history knowledge tell you about that?
My history and knowledge tells me that there's huge amounts of tension in Glasgow and Edinburgh, for instance, right at the moment between Catholics and Protestants.
So it's sectarian.
This is anger that's spilled over from Ireland and has been in the community for at least 200 years. So that there are different tensions. It's interesting that these tensions haven't come out. Maybe the social housing, etc., in the Gorbals and elsewhere has been greatly improved to the extent that people don't want to do the sorts of things they saw in England. I don't know. But certainly there's different tensions, and each community has to be looked at very carefully to see the tensions. The tensions are not the same in every single community that has rioted so far.
One of the analyses here was that it's because those societies, for all their problems that you're just articulating, are actually more open to each other. They're flatter. They don't have the hierarchical structure that still exists in England. And I wonder, Clive, whether you think that's right.
I think that could be right. I simply don't know. I think the answer is that's probably wishful thinking.
Okay.
Be blunt. I mean, because something doesn't happen, it doesn't mean you don't have different circumstances to the ones where it does happen.
Can I just suggest to you both, I've been looking around and no one has suggested, as everybody reaches for trying to grasp at these things, no one's mentioned the decline of religion. I mean, as a binding force that set codes and sanctions and shame and so on, is that playing a role in the very modern ICT-riddled England? First to you, Cheryl, or not? I'm quite happy to be told it's not, but just it's not being talked about.
Maybe in white Britain, but, you know, the presence of religion is very strong in African immigrants, in the high level of Muslim Britons and Sikhs. I don't have an easy answer to that.
Clive?
I think I think most of the communities we're talking about don't have any set religion. Britain is a very secular country. There are obviously areas, especially with religious immigrants, Sikhs, Muslims, even Jewish people, etc., who still stick with the faith. Black people clearly have very strong faith in many of their churches. However, these areas that we're talking about and the people we're talking about do not put their faith in God. The church system has nothing to do with them. They are completely secular.
Mm. Yeah, but they don't put their faith in anything much.
They put their faith in gang culture.
Yeah.
Gang culture gives them self-esteem. Gang culture gives them leadership. And indeed, the gangs in these various parts of London are called the family.
Well,
and so why do Clive, we should look at why are there organised criminal gangs of predominantly boys under 18? And I think the issue you did touch on was lack of education. I mean,
yes.
I know Australians who've taught in London where the kids tell them to F off and then they jump out the window and leave and there's no answer. There's no answer to that.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's very difficult. Obviously, we've moved from a society that has been certain authority in teachers. There's been lots of discussion about what's eroded that authority, whether human rights or God knows what has eroded that. It's difficult. If these kids are jumping out of windows, they're jumping out of windows to do whatever they're doing for a reason. And I don't think we've yet tackled the different possibilities in the education system that we might need to apply to these different groups. We've said that they need to go to university. We've said that they need apprenticeships and vocational work. But maybe there's something else as well, and that needs to be urgently tackled.
Well, I know of a school without walls where the kids meet with teachers in local community parks and buildings in an attempt, that's in Milton Keynes, in an attempt to refashion an approach to schooling for these kind of kids, and it has quite a lot of success.
I'm sure it does have. I'm sure we need to think about the fundamental issues about what... The trouble is we want to punish everybody at the moment, and that makes sense. But
no, it doesn't, because recidivism is 60 to 70% with first-time offenders. So the level of punishment, I think, has to be carefully considered.
Well, I didn't want to necessarily bring in absolutely splenetic responses, but just that we're on... Theodore Dalrymple, who, of course, writes for The Spectator, wrote a piece that was published in The Australian yesterday, and he works in these areas. He's a physician. And I just wonder, Clive, this is pretty hard, I would have thought, for an Englishman to hear. British children are much likelier to have a television in their bedroom than a father living at home. One-third of them never eat a meal at a table with another member of their household. Family's not the word for the social arrangements of the people in the areas from which the rioters mainly come. They're therefore radically unsocialised and deeply egotistical. And he goes on and on in a particularly splenetic way. They're destined not only for unemployment but unemployability. Now, you know, in the past, a lot of us might have said, oh, that's Theodore Dalrymple. But it forces you to consider whether he might be right.
I think there's a level at which he is right. We have to be careful. Here we have someone who is probably middle class, probably very well educated, lives at the highest end of society, and looks on these people askance, a bit patronising perhaps. Because they don't sit at a table, I think really doesn't matter. Because they have a television in their bedroom, well, that's completely irrelevant.
More than a father, that was his point. They're more likely to have a television in the bedroom than a father at home.
There's definitely going to be a large number of these kids who do not have fathers and mothers in the same biological parenting way that the middle class have. And that is a fact, and we can't get away from that. So to sort of condemn them for that is an irrelevance, because you can't condemn someone for something they've never had. If that's not the way marital life is going to go, then you can't force people to get married to look after their children or not to be single mothers. So, you know, the issue is not whether they've got a television. The issue is what are they doing with that television? What are they doing with the family, if there's a family, when they're at home? What is their home circumstances like? And we don't know at the moment.
Final word to you, Cheryl Koerner, because we could go on forever.
I was just going to say, I think we should be asking, if we know it's a fact that fathers will desert their families, what can we do about it? And there have been some good things, some good programs, some sure start programs, where although you can't replace a father, you can try and give people the emotional resilience to fashion a different kind of life. And I don't think we do enough work at the early intervention stage. And for me, the end of the high rise, the less ghettoisation of social housing and early intervention hold some of the keys to the future, plus citizens with their own solutions, because I believe that in most communities, even in the most bleak housing estate, there are really good people who want to change it.
And we haven't even touched on bankers' bonuses and whether they've played a role. That's another whole conversation. Clive Bloom, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Clive Bloom's the author of Violent London, 2,000 Years of Riots and Rebels. And Cheryl Curnow, thank you to you.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Cheryl Curnow, now at the Centre for Social Impact at the University of New South Wales, and writing this week on Crikey. And look, I do welcome your thoughts. You might be interested to know that The Guardian is embarking on a project to catalogue who is going to court and what is happening to them, and they've started that. So if you want to go to their website, you might find it very interesting. And we will keep watching that. And do send us suggestions. Specific angles would be lovely, and we'll try to follow them up, because I think there's a lot of appetite for questions about this.